Make Me Smart is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hello, listeners. If you're hearing this, I'm going to assume you're at least interested in money and understanding the economy and finances. And some of us want our kids to have that knowledge, too. Check out Million Bazillion, Marketplace's award-winning kids podcast that breaks down money to help dollars make more sense. A whole new season is out now. Million Bazillion is presented in partnership with Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Greenlight helps kids and teens learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. You can learn more at greenlight.com/million and tune in to Million Bazillion wherever you find your favorite podcast.
Yeah. So you could put on, I was just listening to How Will I Know by Whitney Houston. So, I mean, you want me to sing some? Yeah, there you go. I was like, I could serenade you if you want.
I love that song. I tweeted about this earlier, but I was driving to get lunch earlier. And I was just, like, dancing in my car. But, like, can you imagine? That it was actually really awkward, like, to feel like you're in your own bubble, and then you look to your left, and someone's staring at you.
Oh, my God.
We're starting.
That's amazing. Yes, and that is a very good story that I kind of want you to retell, but maybe we'll just... First of all, I'm just going to say, hi, I'm Mariel Segarra. Welcome back to Make Me Smart, where we make today make sense. Thank you for joining us. And I'm joined today by, surprise,
I am Rima Gres. I host Marketplace's podcast, This is Uncomfortable, which you should check out if you haven't already. But yeah, it is Wednesday, which means it is What Do You Want to Know Wednesday, the day we answer questions from listeners. So thank you for sending those in. You can always email them to us at makemesmart@marketplace.org or leave us a voicemail at 508-UB-SMART.
And here is our first question.
Let's do it.
Hi, Make Me Smart. This is Ryan from Baltimore, Maryland, and I was hoping you guys could make me smart. How is it that sanctions, economic sanctions, have become the de facto method for dealing with bad actors?
That is a good question, Ryan. So I will take a stab at this. Obviously he is asking about sanctions because it is in the news lately. A bipartisan group of U.S. senators is currently working on a bill that would impose sanctions against Russia, right? Hoping it would stop the country from invading Ukraine, which is looking increasingly likely. So basically, over the years, the U.S. government has relied on sanctions basically as a tool of diplomacy, right? It's seen as this lower cost, lower risk alternative to military force or war, sort of like an in-between solution, right? So instead of putting boots on the ground or just doing straight up diplomacy, there's a way that they can hit them right. They can threaten their cash flow. And that can take a lot of different forms, right? Barring U.S. companies from doing business there, prohibiting access to U.S. banking system. You can also target specific actors by freezing their assets or imposing travel bans. And the point is that it's ideally going to make it tough for a country to do well economically, right? And will hopefully put yet the idea is that the people in the country pressure leadership to continue negotiating with the U.S. or try to accomplish whatever goal it is. And it's interesting. This is actually, it's been a tool that's been used almost since the country was founded. Obviously, one of the more popular examples, obviously, is the Cuba embargo of 1962.
But it goes back to even like Thomas Jefferson, right? In the early 1800s, I think, used embargoes against Britain.
Right, exactly. So long history, which is interesting. And it makes sense the way that the country has used it. It's like a signal to the country and to the world that we're not going to sit back. We're going to do something about this problem. And we really saw, apparently, there was a spike in these kind of sanctions after 9/11 by both political parties. And, you know, the Trump administration apparently has set the record for the number of sanctions, or rather, Trump sets the record for the number of sanctions he imposed. Mm-hmm. But the thing is, there have been a lot of questions, apparently, about the effectiveness of these sanctions. So, you know, it's hard to know sometimes the full impact of them. It's hard to separate it from other factors because, you know, a lot of times economic damage, you can't really know if that's being translated to political change. And it turns out a lot of countries are more resilient than we think. And so there is this criticism that, like, yes, they give the appearance of action and if used alone, they're not as effective. It kind of depends on how much cooperation you get from other nations and if you're using other diplomatic tools, apparently.
Yeah. Well, there are risks to them, right? Like, there's the risk of retaliation. Like, in the case of Russia, it could potentially cut off natural gas shipments to Western countries, particularly European countries that rely on that gas. Or if we are targeting Russia's banks, which could be a huge hit to the country's economy, to Russia's economy, then Russia might target our banks with cyber attacks. And that's something that the Department of Homeland Security is talking about and warning about. And there's also the risk that, for instance, with Russia, if the embargoes shake Russia's economy in the ways that are expected, I mean, these would potentially be really impactful. That could destabilize the global financial system because Russia is a huge country.
Right. Could have a lot of ripple effects.
Yeah. There's a really interesting story from The Atlantic about sanctions and the history of them from back in 2019. And you'd be surprised at how many sanctions the U.S. currently has.
I know.
Yeah. It was like in 2019, it was like just under 8,000 sanctions we had in place. And there's a tool from the Treasury Department where you can look. If you just search, I'm looking at it right now. I search, you can say, click on, it says Nicaragua, search, and then you can see all of the entities and people and companies in Nicaragua that we have sanctions against, or Libya or Syria. And like on the Syria list, Bashar al-Assad shows up, but so do a whole other bunch of people and even aircraft, like particular aircraft. So if you're curious, well, we can put a link to that one on the show page.
Let's put that on the website. Yeah. That's so interesting. Cool. Well, let's move on to the next question. I think this one's for you, Mariel.
My name is Jacob. I'm from San Francisco in the Sunset District. I've got a question about clothing donations. When I drop stuff off at Goodwill, where does it go? Does it all go into that store that I dropped it off at for sale? Or does it go to some like warehouse somewhere? Does it get transferred to another country? Just curious if I'm doing the right thing with my clothing donations. Thanks, guys.
I, too, have had this question.
Yeah, I think a lot of people do. And I guess, Jacob, it depends what you mean by doing the right thing, right? So for Goodwill, to answer your question specifically about Goodwill, when you drop your clothes off, they get sorted by employees. And anything that's considered completely unusable goes into the trash. Then everything else is looked over by workers who decide, okay, here's what this is worth. We're going to put prices on it. Some of the stuff that's considered in really good shape will get put on Goodwill's online marketplace, and then the rest will be in stores. And there's a 4-week shelf life. So if it doesn't sell in 4 weeks, then it gets put in an outlet. Or if it isn't sold at the outlets, then they're basically the clothes are put in bulk, 1,000-pound packaging or 1,000-pound shipments, that is, that are sold to secondhand markets, usually in Central America, South America, countries in Africa, Pakistan. And so that's what happens at Goodwill. And part of the argument for how you might be doing good with your clothes by donating to Goodwill is that you're making those clothes available for pretty cheap for people in the community to buy, but also that Goodwill then takes some of the profit from the sale of those clothes and puts it back into programs that depend on the community. So maybe it's a mentorship program, or maybe it's something like money towards transitional housing. That's how Goodwill works, but there are all other kinds of places you could donate. Like, there might be bins in your community where you could, you know, just throw your clothes in there. And sometimes that's just textile recycling. So if you think your clothes aren't really, can't really be worn again, then that would be a good place to bring them, because then at least maybe you know they're getting recycled.
Right.
If you trust the organization that's running that bin. But if you want your clothes to go directly to someone in need, there are also smaller organizations that do that. Like, I know of one that you can bring office attire for women, and that then is given directly to women who need it. And some women's shelters take donations like that. You can look for particular organizations in your community that do that. So, yeah,
that's cool.
It depends on what doing good means to you, I think.
Yeah. Wow. That's a great answer. I feel like that answered my question about this. It's because I feel like, I don't know about you, but I always have a bunch of like every year I go through my closet, put it in a garbage bag, and then I put it in my car. And sometimes it stays in my car longer than it should. But I try to donate. But I think all of it just makes me realize how much stuff we have. We have so much clothes. Americans in particular, I saw this stat that we buy 5 times more clothing than we did back in the 1980s. And a lot of charities and thrift stores, they just can't handle the amount of clothes that we're giving them, apparently.
Yeah.
And I feel like obviously a big reason is fast fashion. It's just so much easier to buy things and then toss it.
Yeah. I mean, if your concern is the environment, then the place you start is by buying less and being more particular about what you buy and how it's made.
Right. Yeah. I've been trying to become more intentional about that. Whenever I buy something, I'm like, how much am I actually going to wear this?
Yeah. Like, and it's hard. I mean, some of it's expensive. Some, you know, sustainable fashion is expensive. But I guess the argument is that it'll last you potentially longer. Mm-hmm. And if you buy more staple items and things that, I'm wearing a sweater right now from a company that they plant a bunch of trees every time you buy an item from there. But yeah, also these sweaters have lasted me a long time, and it's just a gray knit sweater, but I can wear it over and over again.
Right.
And I have it in gray, I have it in black, you know, so there's that argument, but it is of course a little less fun. It's a little harder to find the stuff that's like, you know, a going out outfit or something with a fun pattern.
Yeah.
That's one trade-off, I guess. But
Before we move on to the next question, I did come across a study that I found pretty interesting where they surveyed a bunch of women and found that the majority of fashion purchases were only worn 7 times, and a third of them considered clothes old after wearing them fewer than 3 times. Which, like, really?
That I feel can like be made worse by Instagram, I think.
Right. Totally.
Yeah. Not wanting to be seen in the same outfit over and over again.
Right.
That's why if you have a black sweater, it's not such a big deal. If your uniform is a black sweater and jeans, then people expect to see you in that. You don't have to really worry about it.
True.
Yeah. Well,
all right.
Our last question comes from Soma, who says, I cook quite a bit, and lately I'm finding that the cost of garlic has skyrocketed. Mm. What's going on?
What is going on with garlic? So before we knew that there was going to be a pandemic back in February of 2020, the Wall Street Journal actually came out with an article that said garlic prices were up because of, quote, a new pneumonia-causing virus had slowed production. So at that time, China was responsible for as much as 80% of global garlic supply, which I had no idea. That's so much. And we reached out to a U.S.-based garlic farmer. His name's Ken Christopher of Christopher Ranch. So he says that California garlic, it makes up about half the total supply of garlic consumed in the U.S., and the rest is imported from China and Spain and Argentina and Mexico mostly. And so all of that imported stuff, obviously, as we've been reporting on a lot of our programs, saw a lot of problems at the ports. And so that drove up demand for U.S.-grown garlic. And so with that, the prices have increased over the last couple of years, and then, you know, demand has obviously shot up during the pandemic, since all of us are apparently trying to become chefs. And so, and garlic apparently is only harvested once a year. So it's a very narrow window to get what you need ready.
Interesting.
Yeah, which I didn't know. And like a lot of other industries, that sector is facing labor shortages because of Omicron. Also disrupting the supply chains. It's just external factors beyond their control, like weather. Being in a drought last year, a lot of farmers in California were complaining about that. Some of them had to rely apparently on emergency water sources, which can get really expensive. And that, of course, that cost is felt by the consumer. We are the ones, unfortunately, who bear the costs.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting. So we have interviewed, or Kai has interviewed Ken Christopher before on the show. And like you were talking about that demand for garlic jumped during the lockdowns because people were cooking more at home.
Right.
It reminded me of this interview that Kai did with Ken in 2020, because he was talking about how the kind of garlic or the way that the garlic is processed depends on who it's for. So it's similar to like in the dairy industry, if you're processing cheese, there are different factories and machines that are used to process a huge wheel of cheese, I think, versus a small thing of cheese, and you use different packaging too. And so if you suddenly have to shift to making a lot more for at-home individual consumption rather than selling to restaurants, you need totally different machines and assembly lines. And that's true for garlic as well, because restaurants traditionally buy pre-peeled garlic. And then for retailers, they buy the garlic that's, you know, wrapped up the way that you would in a store, or that's still in its shell. I don't know what to call it. The way you typically buy it. Yeah. And so they have to adapt now. They've had to adjust their supply chains, and that also can cause some disruptions.
That's interesting. I love the pre-peeled garlics, by the way. It just makes
cooking so much
easier.
You have to use it kind of quickly.
Yeah, that's true. It goes bad pretty quickly.
Mine always gets those like green shoots that pop up.
Yeah.
I still try to use it, but it's just
same.
Like,
and I feel like every time I always Google, can you like,
is
use
this
garlic?
Poisonous?
Right, exactly.
Yeah. The number of times I've Googled, is this poisonous? Like, I think I called poison control once when I ate a grape that tasted weird.
Oh, no.
They were like, I think you're
fine.
What
did
they
tell you? They're like, relax.
They were like, what are you even worried about? I just said it tasted like chalky. I've revealed too much.
Yeah,
I'd like
to
take that back.
No, I feel you though. I get like that too.
Okay. On that note, that is it for us today. Before I reveal too much, tomorrow Kai will be back for Hollowed Out Shell Thursday, and he will be joined by Marketplace's Justin Ho. Keep sending your questions and comments, or something that made you smile. We are at makemesmart@marketplace.org. Or leave us a voicemail. Our number is 508-827-6278, also known as 508-UB-SMART.
Nice. Make Me Smart is produced by Marissa Cabrera. Is the theme music supposed to be going on?
Yeah, it is going.
There we go. Okay, I wasn't hearing it on my end. There we go. Make Me Smart is produced by Marissa Cabrera and Marque Green. It was engineered by Charlton Thorpe, and our intern is Tiffany Bowie.
Ben Talladay and Daniel Ramirez composed our theme music, and our senior producer is Bridget Bodner.
Nice.
Are you cooking dinner tonight?
Dude, I was just thinking that. I have some old garlic, so I need to figure out what I can make.
You could usually make a pasta with that.
Yeah, yeah.
There's something you can throw together. Do you have any, like, protein?
No, negative. I need to go grocery shopping. Stat.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.